The Tom Woods Show, episode 827.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
All you men out there, if you're looking for a smooth, close shave, you need Harry's Razors. They're going to let you try out their shave set for free. Just pay shipping at harrys.com. And when you use code Woods, you get a post-shave balm for free as well. Check it out at harrys.com using code Woods. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. We sure could use more libertarian entertainers. And I'm glad to say that my guest today is one of a small handful of such people. And that's Andrew Heaton, who, among other things, is the author of Laughter is Better Than Communism, a great book we're going to be talking about today that will, of course, be linked to tomwoods.com/827. Andrew is a stand-up comedian, writer, and political satirist. He was voted New York City's greatest new comedian in 2013 by the Broadway Comedy Club. He's also a member of the New York Friars Club, one of the most prestigious groups of comedians and entertainers in the country. He does a video series on a regular basis called Mostly Weekly, where he combines libertarianism and comedy. He's very much worth following, and I'm glad to welcome him today. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to hear you're a friend of Dave Smith, a great comic mind whom I've had on the show and I think very highly of. And turns out you know Michael Malice. So we have a lot of friends in common. So we were bound to say hello one of these days.
Both of those people are on my go-to list for bail money. They're both wonderful people that come to my aid whenever I need them. And I'm not surprised that there's a lot of overlapping folks in our social networks.
So you are a comedian. I've read your book. I love the title of your book, Laughter is Better Than Communism.
Thank you.
I mean, look, it's funny because it's true, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of great stuff in that. We'll get to that in a minute. But you do stand-up comedy in addition to the internet stuff you're doing that's funny and libertarian. When you do your stand-up, is it obvious to people that you might be libertarian? How do you handle that? You're in New York City. Mm-hmm. It's not the most popular political point of view in the world. So how do you handle that?
Well, it's interesting in that I figured out how to kind of get away with it, which is I really ease into my Oklahoma background in New York when I'm on stage. And that kind of, for some reason, inoculates the people. Like if I'm coming out and acting kind of pretentious, they're going to kill me. If I'm voting for Gary Johnson, if I'm coming out and I'm being a little bit folksier, they're usually okay with it. But the main thing to do and that I've found, which I think is a different experience than Dave, is that if I'm doing stand up just for a regular audience with no particular theme going through it, I'm probably not going to delve into politics a lot just because I find that it makes people uncomfortable. Whereas I get booked on political shows with a fairly regular on a fairly regular degree. And in that case, if people know that it's going to be political, I'm pretty upfront about it. And I find it works very well. If you're having an argument with somebody and you're trying to reason them into being libertarian, I find that very difficult. I'm not particularly adept at that. But if people know that they're getting into a political situation, I find that folks are usually very open to laughing at themselves. And I can kind of make fun of liberals and conservatives alike in that context and end up having a good set.
I'm looking at your website right now. It's mightyheaton.com, H-E-A-T-O-N. Mm-hmm. And the one criticism I'm going to make is I can't find on here where I can see you. Do you have regular gigs?
I have regular gigs. I need to update that page. Right now I'm using my Facebook page, also woefully backlogged as my events thing. But I'll take your advice, Tom, and put that on.
Well, I do get to New York at least a couple times a year. And if I was in town and you were doing a show, I'd want to go. And I wouldn't in the back. I wouldn't shout, ask him about politics. See how much you like him then. I wouldn't do that.
Talk about Hayek. like positively heckle me as a libertarian. Do the road to serfdom bit.
Yeah. I always find there's never enough Hayek in stand-up routines. So I wouldn't reproach yourself if I were you. All right. Let's talk a little bit about Laughter is Better Than Communism. Is this a collection of blog posts or articles, or is this something you sat down and just wrote about a bunch of topics?
It's both. I had written several blog posts for the Freeman and for a few other websites and for my own. And then I had things in there that I also wanted to fill in that I thought were missing from it that I thought would be a good addition to the book. For instance, early on in the book, there's one on comparative advantage or you know, just kind of the basic idea of actual growth versus relative growth, which isn't even particularly libertarian, but I think it's such a necessary concept to understand economics. That one I wrote standalone for the book, along with a couple of other chapters like that. So it's probably 3/4 stuff that I'd previously written and about 25% stuff just for the book.
Who did the illustrations?
Oh, those are all mine.
Oh, that's awesome.
With the exception of the actual good illustration on the cover, that was a fellow that I know in Washington, D.C. But all of the cartoons are me. And I've realized that they're pretty good, even being low quality at punctuating jokes and giving it kind of a visual kick. So I put those in and I found that kind of got people that weren't super interested in politics or economics is a way to sort of creep in and look at something funny and then get into the text itself.
Well, and then maybe also it becomes a book that you can give to people, let's say, who are young-ish, like late high school, early college, who, you know, you might not ever be able to get them to look at something like this, but it becomes, I'm sorry to say, I have a book like this too, bathroom reading.
Sure.
And it becomes, because they can read one thing at a time and nothing depends on reading anything before it. But also I didn't know it was going to be illustrated like this. So as I started flipping through it, and they're hysterical. I love it. I love what the characters are saying. I love the drawings. It's really well done. So you cover all kinds of things. I mean, it really becomes another intro text that you can give, because we're always wondering on this show. All right, I have somebody who said, all right, listen, I'm willing to give your cockamamie philosophy a shot, but you got one chance. You know, you give me one book, or one recommendation I've made is you offer with your friend to read a book that the friend recommends if that friend will read a book you recommend.
Ah, this is...
You know, because then maybe they will read it.
I think that this would be great for that purpose, because if you sat down and went, you know, I want you to read this Doorstop that's, you know, eight point font, and it's going to take you 12 days to read it if you do it every day. That's kind of a hard ask.
Yeah.
This one is I aspire to be a bathroom book. And so this is an easy one done, you know, in between bowel movements in terms of time commitments. The other thing, I think you mentioned somebody coming out of high school or somebody in college. I think it's perfect for that range of people, because most of the posts that I write in there, at least are the chapters that I write in there, at least when it gets to economics, is not so much libertarian screeds as just basic things that I should have been taught while I was in college.
Exactly.
That kind of like I brought up relative growth versus actual growth a minute ago. I didn't learn that till I was getting my master's degree. And even then, I kind of learned it inadvertently, because the master's degree was in international politics, but I took an economics course for fun. And that blew me away, because the idea that, people freely associating are going to be better at specializing in things is a powerful concept. And then the idea that, if I get rich, it does not necessarily take away from you. In fact, most of the time it helps both parties. That's mind blowing to most of myself and most people coming out of college, where there's a presumption that inequality is the cause of poverty, and that the best thing you can do is just sort of cap wealth, and that will sort of force all of this, dribble up economic program to work. So that's something where even I don't even really care if you become libertarian, but I want that to get out there, because then I'll at least be dealing with people that are economically literate and can sit down and have a conversation, and hopefully we can get on the same page a little bit more.
I know this isn't one of the central themes, but I was struck because of the illustrations by the way you deal with congressional gerrymandering, where they take districts, and this is I have about probably 18% of the listeners are from other countries. I'm sure they do this elsewhere in the world too, but it's some district where all these people vote for the same congressman, but they shape the district in an increasingly bizarre way in order either to be favorable toward one side or to punish another, make it harder and harder for another one to win. But you make sure that you shape it so that this little blob up here that has a lot of opponents of that person suddenly is included. And so I love the Illinois 19th district. What you've done for each of these is you show what the district looks like. It's a bizarre shape. And then you approximate it in a drawing. So the drawing for Illinois' 19th district is a mermaid flipping you off. And you look at it, and it does look like a mermaid giving you the bird. And yet I'm looking at your drawing of a mermaid. A mermaid is female, Andrew. I got to tell you that. You've clearly drawn a man here.
That's true. You're right. It is a merman. You found the one error in the book that was caught post-print. Everything else is completely accurate. Yeah, that was one of my favorite chapters. And that goes back to I worked for Congress for about a year. I'm sorry. And one of the things that really struck me when I was there was I would walk to various offices. And usually offices in Congress have a map of the district in the front office when you come in. And it's amazing that some of them look like, a dynamite keg cartoon explosion. It's so clear that they have been carved out in such a way as to benefit the incumbent. And it's one of those things where that, too, is something that I'd really like to put out of the national conversation, because we hear all the time, we're so partisan today. Everybody's so extreme. And I think that that's true. But I think a really big part of that is the fact that we're cutting up congressional districts and other districts in such a way that it benefits you to be in a party and a hyper-partisan member of that party. I thought it was funny to kind of use it as a Rorschach test. In addition to that, like stingrays, there's a monkey throwing a boomerang. That would be the New York area, because if your district is touching water, that counts as contiguous with something else not otherwise touching your district. So you can create all sorts of fantastic shapes. It's great from an artistic perspective, but bad for democracy.
Let's talk about your comments on voting and reform you would make. I want you to explain it, but at first, because I actually, I don't like the whole system, but I think the Electoral College is the least bad of the possible alternatives. So when I saw your chapter challenging the Electoral College, I thought, oh, darn. So not only is he wrong about mermaids, he's wrong about this. But then when I read what your proposal was, I thought that actually would be an improvement. And I want you to explain what it is, because for this reason, that there are people who might have voted for, let's say, a Ron Paul, but they say, but he's not going to win, or, I'm not so sure about him. But you give them those sorts of people a fallback position. So how would that work? I think it's a good idea, actually.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm a very big fan of the alternate vote. And that's something that isn't, some crazy untried system. They have it in a lot of countries. In the United States, we have a first-past-the-poll system where whoever has the most votes wins. And that means that in the last election, you had to decide between either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, or potentially being a spoiler. People that went for Jill Stein really got it afterwards. I voted for Gary Johnson, but I live in New York. Because of the Electoral College, it didn't really make a difference. If I'd lived in, say, Virginia, it would. And so I think as a result of that, there are a lot of people that do support Ron Paul, or in this election probably would have supported Bernie Sanders if he'd run third party, but are very afraid to actually vote for him in the primaries or the election itself. So what an alternate vote does is it just does your candidates by order of preference. You would list, in my case, in this election, it would have been Gary Johnson, and then after that, probably Jill Stein, and then an impersonator of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, and then finally Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But what would have happened is all of those candidates became non-viable. It would have just my vote would have fallen to the next person on the list, which means you could list ideologically whoever you want to be president, and if they weren't going to get it, it wouldn't throw your vote away. It would just kick your vote to the next viable candidate. I think that would be great. It'd be wonderful for a national conversation. You'd actually get a feel for the amount of support for a candidate. And I think that would really surprise people. I think that folks would be astonished at how well a third party candidate would do if they weren't a spoiler.
And not only that, we could finally stop people from saying a vote for X is really a vote for Y.
Yes.
You know what? A vote for X, believe it or not, is actually a vote for X. How about that?
Yes, I am of that opinion, regardless of the system. I would probably, if I were in a swing state, I would be more careful about it. I would probably vote for one of the two party candidates in a swing state under our current regime. But I think it would be much better to swap into the alternate vote. And like I said, that's something they do in France. I rarely hold up France as a beacon of reform that I want to model the United States after. But in terms of their elections, I think they've got a good system going.
Yeah, that's a very interesting idea. All right, a lot more interesting ideas. Laughter is indeed better than communism. We're going to keep proving that after we thank our sponsor. Folks, it's time for the story of Bad Luck Ichabod. We haven't heard from Bad Luck Ichabod in quite some time, but I'll tell you something. What a lousy shave Bad Luck Ichabod always got when he shaved with a blade. No matter what he did, his face wound up a bloody mess, and he couldn't understand how everybody else was getting this smooth, comfortable, close shave, and he looks like he's just been part of an axe murder movie. Well, folks, just like the walrus was Paul, I was Bad Luck Ichabod. That's right, I'm revealing the true identity of Bad Luck Ichabod. I was Bad Luck Ichabod. I could not shave with a blade. I just thought it was something wrong with me, so I've just been shaving with electric. But then I tried Harry's, and it is so smooth and comfortable. I look great. I feel great. I feel like I know what I'm doing now. So I want to recommend it to you. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they want you to try their shave set for free. You heard that right. Just cover shipping when you sign up. Plus, as a special offer for fans of the show, go to harrys.com right now and enter code WOODS at checkout to get a post-shave balm also free. That's harrys.com, code WOODS. All right, getting back to Laughter is Better Than Communism. Just love that title. I'm linking to that book, by the way.
Great.
TomWoods.com/827 is our show notes page. And this is also where you can get to Andrew's site and what Andrew's up to. We'll talk about your videos in a minute. But let's talk about student debt. This is a big crisis. All these kids are in debt, and they have no prospects, and they're sitting on a couch playing video games all day, which might have something to do with it, by the way. what are you recommending? That we relieve them of this debt? I know what your actual recommendation is. I did read the book. I'm just setting you up. So go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad you read the book. No, I'm not for that. On a moral level, I forewent going to a nice boat shoe school over on the East Coast. I went to a state college because I didn't want to go in a highly highly debt ridden way, which was great because I became a comedian, and so I would have been underwater for sure. There are a few things that I think we should do. One thing that I've kind of taken as a tact on discussing this after the book came out is bringing up Bernie Sanders, because that was one of his really big issues, and he got a lot of students on his side by saying, we're going to make college free, by which he means we're going to have the government pay for college. And my question is, okay, how did college get so expensive? Because usually in the liberal model, things are expensive because businessmen are evil and greedy, and they drive up prices. But most of these colleges are public colleges. Most of these companies that are providing resources aren't—they've got a heavy amount of public funding going into them, if not public in and of itself. So why has it become so expensive? I think there's multiple reasons for that, but one of the big ones is that we've completely disassociated the price of college from the actual cost of college, and the cost of it has gone through the roof. I feel for people that are suffering under student debt. It's not a lot of fun. My thought would be to treat it like a business. For one thing, I think you should be allowed to declare bankruptcy if you have student debt. That's, to my knowledge, the only form of debt in the United States that you can't declare bankruptcy on, and that's odd. And then the other thing, Rand Paul had a strategy of using your student loans as basically tax deductible towards whatever your job was, which I think makes sense. That's a way to deal with it. And then the long term, the thing that I would do is have companies themselves provide student loans and treat it like an actual loan. So if I did history and world religions as my undergraduate topics, I probably wouldn't have got a lot of money to pursue that because there's not a very big religion factory and there's not a very big history factory. Whereas if I'd said, I really want to go into engineering, they would have done that. So right now we're cranking out all these people that, like me, have a liberal arts degree that aren't really geared for the workforce and are expecting somebody else to pay for it. I think that there's a ton of students that are getting misled into spending a lot of money on something that's not going to recoup. And an easy way to do that would be to get businesses into the college loan system, because then you wouldn't really have this warping in the market.
I want to also talk about, I love your little essay, Do I Deserve Your Waiter's Money? And I love the illustration because there's a waiter and he's serving wine to a woman in a restaurant. And with his back turned, there's a person, perhaps this is you, leaning back in your chair, pulling some money out of his pocket.
Yeah.
So this has to do with the government funding of the arts, which is one of those things, by the way, that most people would just find unimaginable that you could oppose. What are you talking about? What are you against the arts?
Yeah. Do I hate Big Bird? Do I want to close NPR?
Yes and yes. I'm only kidding. Big Bird's fine.
Yeah, I mean, like, I really like NPR, and if NPR were made a completely private entity and it were for want of money, I'd be happy to chip in $5 out of my pocket to keep it going. This is something that I think most people would be aghast at, and particularly, you know, my friends within the comedy community would really be aghast at that. Most of the comedians I know and most of the writers I know would love to get a grant from the National Institute of Humanities or some other government apparatchik board that's going to pass out cash. I mean, on a broader level, I think something that is oftentimes forgotten with our friends on the left is that society is a lot bigger than government. So if we say, I don't want to fund the arts through the government, we're not saying we don't want to fund the arts. We're just saying we don't want to force people to fund the arts and then send that money based off of what bureaucrats think would be good arts.
But let me jump in here, because I think some people would say, that's basically the same position. I don't favor the arts, and I don't favor art funding by the government. There just isn't going to be sufficient art funding without the government, so that's why we need it. So this is a cop-out on your part. I can anticipate that.
Well, thanks for jumping in there. I think that there's plenty of evidence to indicate that that's not the case, and that there's, you know, a tremendous amount of art museums, private institutions, podcasts like the one we're on, television shows, all these different things that are expressions of the arts that aren't publicly funded. I can think of nothing worse than publicly funded comedy. That sounds terrible to me. The government's basically a giant human resources department with tanks. Having those same people, the human resources department of our country, figure out what comedy should be accessible is not even in terms of censorship, just in terms of the kind of content produced. It would be awful. It would be terrible. And then beyond that, kind of the central thesis of that chapter is I've been a waiter. I've been a struggling comedian. When I wrote the book, I had very, very little money. I think I did pay taxes that year, but just barely. The idea that you're going to subsidize artists, comedians, whatever, you're still taxing other artists and comedians. You're still all the waiters in New York, virtually every actor in New York is a waiter or something else. You're still taxing all of those people, but then you're giving their money to people that won the lotto or that are connected to whatever board disperses these things. And I don't want to do that. I think it's an immoral thing to take money from other artists and then give that to the connected artist. I would rather it be incumbent upon us to convince, I don't know, the Koch brothers or whoever to fund us or to sell stuff, to figure out a way to actually get people to look at our things.
All right. Let's shift now and talk about the videos that you do. What's the series called? And then let's talk about the one you did on licensing.
Okay. The series is called Mostly Weekly, and it is basically a poor man's Colbert show from a libertarian standpoint. So we put out videos most weeks. They're usually 3 to 5 minutes, and they're coming from my perspective, which is a libertarian viewpoint. With the licensing episode, which is a really fun one, we kind of go through all the ridiculous things you need a license for in the United States. For example, most states, you need a license to be a mortician.
I didn't know that.
I'm thinking, you need a mortician license, which what's the worst thing you could do? I mean, the worst thing you could do as a mortician is bring the body back to life, I think. Like, it's not a situation where I get having people licensed for brain surgery. That makes sense to me. I follow the logic there. We don't want people doing really, really dangerous things that involve blood to be unlicensed. Okay. All right. But wait, again, with a mortician, the guy's already dead. There's no threat there. It's basically just to protect that industry. And then also in a lot of states, in Florida has all sorts of crazy laws. Florida, if you're a soothsayer or a psychic, you need a license, which I find funny. And then, for instance, in Massachusetts, in Salem, Massachusetts, there's a lot of psychics. And a licensing regime came in. Or I'm sorry, it had previously been licensed, and then they removed that, and the market flooded with more psychics. So the old psychics started complaining, where I would have to say, you know, how did you not see this coming? But again, psychics, I don't see why they would need licensing. Are we having the government say which psychics are accurate? No, because ultimately it's not about that. It's about protecting people that are already in a particular position from people outside of that position. It's about protecting the incumbents from newcomers. And so most licenses, I think, are regressive and hurt poor people. And I'm basically going on a rant, but the episode's a funny way of explaining that.
Yeah, so I'm going to – let me actually jot down. I want to make sure and link to the licensing episode in particular just to give people an introduction to what it is that you're doing. And that is a tough topic to cover because – unfortunately, you're coming at it in front of people who have been trained to believe that the people in charge have nothing but their own individual well-being at heart, and that these are good, selfless public servants, and that's why we have government, is to provide for the, you know, for people's safety and well-being. And the idea that, well, actually, it looks like it's a collusion between the already existing and established firms and the government as against the upstarts. Well, that's not what people are prepared to hear. No one's ever told them that. So what's wrong with Andrew Heaton becomes the way they think.
Yeah, well, you're right. I think most people have this weird idea that once you're elected to public office, you become a Vulcan and all of your emotions and self-interest are gone. I'm even willing to give the benefit of the doubt to most people in government that they're not, you know, evil or anything. But with licensing, some of these are so cut and dry where I'll give an example that's also in the book. When I lived in Washington, D.C. last, at one point I was a Segway tour guide and I had to get a license to do that. I assumed, and I wasn't even mad about it initially going into it, I assumed that the license was going to be to make sure I understood traffic laws, that I knew what to do if someone was injured. And it turned out to be an absurd test. One of the questions said something to the effect of, how much land does the federal government own, 34, 25, 43, or 56? And it didn't say what percentage, how many acres. I mean, the question literally was not answerable. But that wasn't the point. The point of it was to try and keep people from breaking into that particular field and protect the tour guides from coming in. The bigger challenge with the video, in my opinion, is making it not wonky, which is something that libertarians tend to do. We tend to you know, try and pillar a particular topic with reason and logic. Most people don't arrive at conclusions through reason and logic. They arrive at conclusions through emotion. And so comedy is a pretty good way to do it. And if for your listeners, you just have to trust me, the episode's a lot funnier than I'm being right now. But it tackles that in a funny way. And there's a lot of spit takes.
One more thing. I want to just ask you something that has nothing to do with libertarianism, but I'm curious and intrigued by your, you know, your field, comedy. That's a tough thing to do when you're really good at it. People know you're good at it, but they don't know the half of it, of how hard what you're doing is. But when you're bad, oh, they know that right away. They can see that right away. And it's brutal. And once you've bombed, there's no coming back. Did that ever scare you?
Oh, yeah. Doing stand-up comedy is like learning to play a guitar in front of people. And it's doubly tough in that say my musician friends, if they do a performance and somebody doesn't like it, it's like, well, they don't really care for your style of music. If you do stand-up comedy and someone doesn't like you, they don't like you as a person. I mean, you're literally being rejected. I've thought a lot about this. I think the reason for that is that, you know, our species is about 200,000 years old. Most of that period, we were wandering around the Serengeti, killing stuff with sticks. I think that for most of mankind and our predecessors' existence, if 200 people just got real quiet and stared at you, it meant they were about to kill you with rocks, or you were about to be eaten by a cougar. And so it's not a normal experience to get up in front of a bunch of people and try and make them laugh. And that does make me nervous sometimes. I find, though, in my case, I've been doing it long enough that it's rare for me to just bomb. I know what jokes work. And so I find once I get up and I do a couple of jokes and get the audience laughing, then I'm fine and they're fine as well. But it is tough. And I will say that when you do bomb, which happens on rare occasion, it is a horrific feeling. It's like if you've ever seen one of your friends do something so embarrassing you couldn't make eye contact with them, it's that except it's you. And you have to slink home with it. Fortunately, that doesn't happen that often. I'm usually able to get an audience laughing, if not uproariously laughing, and go from there.
Wow. Well, what about competition? Are there a lot of you out there?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you make this a regular thing? How can you know from week to week, well, there's so many comedians competing with me, maybe I won't get a gig this week or that week or whatever. Isn't it hard?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I should specify, I'm not a full-time comedian. I work in television as my day job, because I guess I'm not that funny. But the field itself, yeah. I think, though, that the way to look at it is not like it's a zero-sum game. It is in one sense. If you want to do clubs, that's a zero-sum game, because clubs only have a certain amount of time that they can fill, which means they only have X amount of people that they can bring in. So it might be tough to say, become a regular at the Comedy Cellar or something like that. But I think the way to get around that is to make your own opportunities. I wrote a book. I do a web series. You can write as many books or web series as you want, and you're not really competing with other people. You're trying to make a niche for yourself, which is one of the reasons I kind of started doing libertarian comedy. And I get paid much better doing political comedy than I do observational comedy. The reason, I think, is because there are three funny people in America that also like Milton Friedman. They get on stage and do jokes. I think you're funny as well, Tom, and you probably like Milton Friedman. There's a ton of people here in New York that are kind of awkward white guys that want to crack jokes about how hard it is to date. So that's a field where I can be very funny, but I am swamped by the amount of other people trying to do the exact same thing. Whereas if I go to DC or I go to a think tank and I do political comedy, I'm one of like maybe three people doing that. And so that's a situation where my libertarian instincts identified a market opportunity. And I went, oh, okay, I can, you know, I'm pretty funny for a stand-up comedian, but I'm really funny for a libertarian. So I can make that work.
Yeah, that's true. You know, believe it or not, there are some libertarians who are quite ponderous and not funny at all. We'll just leave it at that. Well, I'm glad you're able to do that. And you're right. That is a fantastic niche, because they might as well capitalize on the fact that you're a extremely bizarre minority. Right. I mean, might as well make that work for you.
And on top of that, this one of the reasons I started doing mostly weekly is that when it comes to political satire, it's dominated by the left, and there's really not a lot of viewpoints on it. There's you know, like Samantha Bee is a woman, Trevor Noah is black. Like there are different viewpoints happening there, but they're all coming out of the same mindset, which is progressive liberalism, and the range of opinions of people doing political satire is pretty much from, we like Bernie Sanders, but we're going to vote for Hillary Clinton, to we like Hillary Clinton and we're going to vote for Hillary Clinton. It's this pretty narrow bandwidth. And so I look at that and I'm like, well, there's, you know, half the people in the country don't really agree with that viewpoint. Hailing from that half, I think we still have a pretty good sense of humor. And so what I'm trying to do is carve out a position where I'm doing political satire, but I'm doing it for a libertarian and a center right audience, where, you know, people in Oklahoma, Texas, Kentucky, or whatever can watch me, and I'm not going to be browbeating them. And in fact, my opinions are going to be pretty congruent with theirs.
Well, I'm going to make sure and link to your stuff. I want people to get to know you. TomWoods.com/827 is where we're going to have the Andrew Heaton smorgasbord. You can go and visit him directly at mightyheaton.com. And if you live in New York City, maybe you'll get a chance to see him. And I guess your Facebook page, so you have not just a Facebook profile, like a regular wall, but you also have a fan-ish page, or what do you have?
Yes. Yeah. If you go to the quickest route for that would be andrewheaton.tv. which links to my Facebook page. You can get all this stuff on mightyheaton.com. But if you go to the Facebook page, you'll just see the videos. There's a lot of sketch comedy. There's every episode of Mostly Weekly. And so there's a tremendous amount of me being funny right there that you can check out. And if you like me, I would appreciate it, because that's an easy way for me to disseminate episodes and things coming out and stay posted on that.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, let's see. I just clicked like on it just this second. So if
Thank
I could
you,
do
Tom.
It, anybody could do it. So andrewheaton.tv is just a redirect to your Facebook page. It's an easy way for people to get
yeah.
there. So get the heck over there. Help Andrew Heaton out. We have, as you said, we have like three people like him. We can't support three people. It's you, Dave Smith. And I don't even know who the third guy is.
I'm just giving the benefit of the doubt. I assume there's one guy out there.
There's got to be somebody you and I haven't met before, right? There's got to be somebody. You'd think there'd have to be. All right, listen, I'm really glad to talk to you. Maybe we can do this again. Best of luck with what you're doing.
Thank you, Tom. It was a lot of fun. I hope to be on again.
All right, everybody, do check out Andrew Heaton. Got all the stuff that you need at TomWoods.com/827. Remember also, I have a bunch of free libertarian ebooks that take on some of the toughest questions you are likely to encounter, and you can learn how to answer them for nothing. How do you do that? You just go to tomsfreebooks.com. There's no downside to this. There's free books and there's you. You know, put it together and there you go. So tomsfreebooks.com is where you ought to go. And I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.